We need to order. Start with roll call. Howard Chung. Bridget Davila. Is Bridget on the phone?
She isn't.
Okay, so Bridget is in Washington, D.C., so she's going to participate by phone tonight. So she'll be here. Kate Favetti.
Here.
Christine Godinez.
Here.
Rebecca Lee.
Here.
Robert Mulbauer. Maria Picard.
Here.
Lisa Sterling. John Winston.
Here.
Great, okay. So context for tonight's meeting is just to kind of give, hi, everybody. Nice to see the familiar faces. Thanks for coming to be part of tonight's meeting. So a couple things. First is that we're going to get a chance to look at the second round edited versions of what we gave feedback to last time. And the other principal parameters will be looking at the first round feedback and soliciting additional feedback. So that's kind of the frame of tonight. We also did something differently with the last meeting, which is, I don't know if you remember, but we led with general comments because we had so many people who wanted to speak. So one thing that I'm going to be doing tonight is that as we go through the parameters and principles, we know, the first thing to know is that we have been working, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in a bit, is that we know that we're going to be slowing down the process and we're not pushing through to get done. We're pushing through to gain as much community input as needed to get to consensus around feeling good about what we put forward in the RFP in terms of the principles. So that's the frame of how we're thinking about it. And with that, tonight at about 7:30, I'm going to make a judgment call as to exactly how many principles, more principles we'll go through, because we know City College is a really big one, and we want to be able to give that its due. And then we have two that are smaller, and depending on how the timing goes, we know already that we won't get through everything on the agenda, but we have it all articulated so you kind of know what's coming up. So that's kind of a little bit of context for tonight. And one other thing I'd like to offer is that because Philip has been doing such a great job with the minutes, we have seen the minutes more like a transcript than like minutes. And so you'll see a difference in the minutes tonight. We're going to move to approve them now. And what you're going to see is that the minutes look a little different. They're a little bit more general. And the intention of that is for them to really be minutes, as they were never really intended to be a transcript, a fiscal transcript of the meeting. So with that, that's a little bit of context. So if everyone's had a chance to take a look at the minutes, and I'd like to ask our community members if anyone has any feedback to the minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, it was on page 6 of 14. On my comments?
Maybe just
the mic
over there.
Okay.
It's on page 6 of 14. My comments were that we have to think in terms of planning for millennials, but then there are generations behind the millennials, and those are the year urban creative urban professionals. And so the concept is you just don't plan for today, you plan for tomorrow too. And then I would move to approve.
Second.
Okay. John seconded. Okay. All in favor? Well, I've got to go to comment. I've got to go to public comment. So anybody have any changes to the minutes?
It's my statement on page 13, and just a clarification of number 5. It says 30 years ago we took care of 200 units. It sounds as though there were 200 units of housing built. There were no units of housing built. So just a sort of clarification. I don't know if it takes words, but it reads as though I was saying we built 200 units of housing, and there were no units of housing. And I will ask the question again, I guess, the first question later on in the minutes. And I just wanted to say, number 9 says strong language. Was that me? I don't know what strong language means in that context. I hope I wasn't using strong language.
Okay. And any other feedback to the minutes? Okay, so with those changes?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Hi, Christine Hansen. So on page 14, under, the sentences just kind of don't make sense. So under number four, public realm, daily experience for diverse neighbors, there was no mention in your parameter that it is currently and continuing to be used for parking. So I don't know if that's, I know that was my intent, I can't remember my exact words, but it doesn't quite come through in that sentence. And then where it says number seven, no mention of parking as a need, there is no mention in the parameters as a parking as a need, for part of parking as a need.
Okay.
And then it needs, and then I'm pretty sure on number six, I said public land should stay in public hands. Thank you.
Any last comments, changes, feedback? Okay, so with those edits, we have. Do you want to call
the question?
Yes. Yeah. So we have a motion to approve.
Oh, wait, I moved.
You moved. Second.
Second. Bring other public comment.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Bridget. So, Bridget, and since you're on the phone by this little contraption, which we should just take a picture and send it to you because it's pretty hilarious. You're right, you're at the corner of the table right next to the microphone. So let us know if you are unable to hear, okay?
It is a little fuzzy.
Yeah. The iPhone is not the Polycom space phone. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so. So let's now turn to just remind everybody of our ground rules. I want to thank everybody for being very respectful in how we're communicating and giving each other feedback. I've appreciated how we have come together as a community to do this. And I have one last thing, which is for the April meeting of Monday, April 11th, I am going to be in Washington. I'm going to be out of town. So I'd like to see if we could move that meeting to either the 13th or the 14th later that week. I'm gone for about 2.5 weeks. I'll be back on the 12th. So I just want to put that out there now that we're going to, I'd like to see if we can change it to the 13th.
It's a March meeting?
April.
There's no March meeting.
There's a March meeting. Yeah, just we're thinking a little bit ahead because we know we're not done.
No, I wondered if you skipped something.
No, thank you. So we can, and it's okay, I just want to make a note of that. Take a look at your calendars, we'll do an email, and then we can.
You're looking at, can you repeat that again?
So the April meeting is Monday, April 11th.
Uh-huh.
I can't make that meeting, so I don't know if we can meet on the 13th or the 14th instead. Does anybody have a problem with that?
14th, it'd have to be after 6:30.
Is the 13th okay?
The 13th would be okay, yes.
Maria?
I'm good on either.
I think it's pretty good, though.
I think it's pretty good, okay. Wednesday, April 13th is what we're looking at. Is it possible for you, Bridget?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll finish.
I don't know if I can make it. I'll let you
Okay, so we'll announce it and we'll put it online, but I just wanted to call that out and let everybody hear that now. We've got a little bit of notice 8 weeks out. Okay. Okay. So now we're going to move to the to talk about the housing, urban design, and public realm parameters. And as I know, I thought it was. Going into housing. Okay, so we're going to go, not my context for tonight's meeting, your context for tonight's meeting, our context
yes.
for tonight's meeting. Okay, so we're going to go and get the context for tonight's meeting. Jeremy, are you, Emily's leading. You're going to tag team. Okay, here we go.
Thanks, Lisa. Sorry about that. We have a lot of moving parts tonight, as you know. So just to provide a little bit more context for what we're doing tonight, as you all know, the near-term goal for the city and for the CAC is to really lay the groundwork for selecting a development partner for the site. Yeah, we can just move to the second slide. So, you know, we've been working since the summer to get your feedback on and to revise and iterate through a set of parameters that will kind of be our criteria, not just for selecting a development partner to build the project, but also to kind of guide our conversations and our negotiations with that partner once they come on board. So tonight, as Lisa said, we're going to consider the second round of revisions to the urban design, housing, and public realm parameters and time permitting our first round of revisions that we're proposing to several of the other sets of parameters. You know, if you look back at the schedules that we had presented at previous meetings, we had originally hope that we could wrap this up this month. And you know, clearly we haven't been able to do that. We wanted to slow down in order to have enough time to really be thoughtful and iterative, to take all the feedback and make revisions and work through it. And I know that Mayor Lee and Supervisor Yee have mentioned that to some of you. My boss, Ken Rich, also kind of highlighted that when we presented to the City College Board of Trustees a few weeks ago. So just want to make sure that everyone is on the same page there. And if I could have the next slide, please.
Yeah, thank you.
So what we think that means in terms of our next few meetings. So tonight, as I said, we're going to focus on the third draft of three sets of parameters. In March, we're envisioning focusing on three other sets of parameters, the project's relationship to City College, additional public benefits, and sustainability. We actually have that agenda as the final item tonight, and if we have time, we can start that conversation, but we'll kind of see how things go and leave that to Lisa to make that call. And then in April, we'd like to really focus the whole meeting on transportation. We know that transportation, parking, congestion have been huge concerns. I think you'll see that our revisions to some of the non-transportation parameters are taking feedback into account and figuring out new ways to address them. But again, we really want to have another meeting devoted to transportation as part of this stage in the process. And then we're hoping that by May, we'll have been able to do enough rounds and have enough feedback that the CAC can come back together with all of the parameters and talk about finalizing them. You know, another big piece of that is not just our monthly meetings with the CAC and those of you who are able to attend them, but also concurrent community engagement. So we're going to be doing additional stakeholder outreach. There have been a number of groups suggested different constituencies within the City College community in particular, and we you know, are happy to hear additional suggestions. So we'll be doing that outreach, and we've also been really happy that we're now in dialogue with the City College Board of Trustees. Had our first chance, we were invited to present to them on the status of the project a few weeks ago, and we'll be continuing to do that. So, so just kind of before turning it over to the CAC to discuss the parameters, we just wanted to give a recap, which we haven't done in a little while, of kind of what the parameters are intended to do and why the CAC is focusing on them as kind of its first charge. So you know, they're about communicating to prospective developers the core values that we want to see in the project. They're a way to identify, as part of those values, the concerns and the problems that we want the project to solve. They set baseline requirements and then encourage developers that are proposing to partner with us to actually exceed those baseline parameters through the competitive selection process. As part of those baseline parameters, they're setting a maximum physical envelope for kind of the shape of what can be built. But they're trying to balance kind of those hard, fast values with providing enough flexibility. So people can continue to give meaningful input. We can continue to do analysis and then learn from that analysis and be responsive to it. And the team that comes on board can really be creative and bring all of their expertise to the table. And then finally, you know, as a statement of values, they provide kind of the basis for ongoing negotiation with the developer partner to finalize what the project is going to be in all of its details. And so going along with that, you know, they're not, the goal of them is not to stringently determine every detail of every aspect of the project. And related to that, they're not, this process is not part of the formal environmental review process that will be required under the California Environmental Quality Act or CEQA once there actually is a project that's detailed enough and baked enough to study. So we're not doing CEQA right now. I know there have been questions about that. This is kind of the prelude to that more detailed part of the process. Similarly, determining the project's physical design in its details within the envelope that we're setting now is something that comes later. You know, we have to have our developer partner at the table for that conversation in order to make sure that what we come up with is something that they're actually going to be willing to build. So Jeremy Shaw from the Planning Department, who many of you know, is going to take just a few more minutes to really underscore how much additional input and involvement is going to happen in the design process once that developer gets on board. That will hopefully provide some comfort to, you know, this is really just the beginning.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming in on such a beautiful afternoon. Something we can celebrate for a minute. I'll make this quick, but happy to talk more after the meeting. Or if anyone has questions now. This timeline, I would imagine many of you have seen, we're where that bright yellow star is, which is CAC meetings, right in the beginning of 2016. Can you see that in the back? Yeah? All right. And what I wanted to do now, just take a few minutes, it was to illustrate what we mean by community design workshops, what's going to happen in the future, because especially for me, we've heard a lot that we will be talking about that later. We'll be talking about that later. And so what is that and what are those conversations? And again, keep in mind that this is an ongoing conversation, as Emily said. Once the RFP goes out and a developer team with architects is selected, there will be what will most likely be more than a year of community design workshops. And that is just what I wanted to illustrate tonight. This is over the course of months and months, and it allows us to have a more detailed conversation when the time is right. So just to give you an overview, we start those meetings with the developer and architects at the table, so we have the expertise and designers, so people who can actually make change and find creative solutions are there talking with you. But they don't start from nothing. We've been meeting with a lot of the individuals in this room and other folks who couldn't make it tonight for over a year now, and we have a big docket of information and public input to date. And so the developer and architects that are chosen will certainly be aware of all the prior neighborhood input. As Emily mentioned, we are in a constant dialogue with City College, and so they will be at the table as well, and future plans for the campus will be made clear to the future architects in Balboa Reservoir. And of course, the parameters and goals and language that we discuss in these meetings here, which will also continue in parallel to the community design workshops, those will be available for those future workshops. And that's before we even get started. So we have a lot of information already. And then we do some more exciting conversations. So instead of having the sort of back and forth at the microphone like tonight, we might be able to take a moment to go actually walk on the site and point to things and look at the same, you know, have conversations about things in real life, in real time. Some of you might have been on the Ocean Avenue on this tour. This was a design tour for the Ocean Avenue project. This was a similar workshop for that same project. You might recognize a couple faces in there. And that, again, gives us the time to break out into smaller groups and really talk about designs and creative solutions in a more human way at a table with pictures and pens and get down to details. These are some examples of a similar project that happened in Visitation Valley a few years back, and the point is just to illustrate that we can get a lot of ideas really quickly in pictures, and that is a great way to communicate to the future developers of the site what you are thinking, and when we have the developer and the designer at the table, they can facilitate those conversations. So if there is a debate or a trade-off that we have to make, having a designer at the table will help find those solutions for those trade-offs. And so we're really looking forward to that. And in a nutshell, just going to blow through these because the workshops aren't fully designed yet, but just conceptually, when we have a community design workshop, we'll talk about land use concepts in general. Where should residential go? Where should commercial, if there is commercial, go? We talk about an open space framework or armature, and clearly that's something that's important to this community. We want to make sure the whole development is responsive and supportive of the open space plan. So that'll be an important part of the design workshops.
What does the word armature mean?
Sorry, framework, a structure for open space, because it is an object in itself, the open space network. We want to make sure it's connected and works on its own, and of course works with the land use itself. We'll talk about access and transportation networks too, and overlay all these competing needs on the site and really get to look at pictures and designs to make sure that each of those needs is served. And then from those workshops, we'll have a more general, refined sort of land use concept or urban design that we can work with, and then take that back to the shop again and iterate on again and get down to further details. Some of those details we've talked about to a degree in these meetings. For instance, shadows, lights, privacy, heights. We have a generalized framework in words, in the language. That's what we'll be discussing tonight and ongoing in this meeting. But really, when we have the designer at the table, we'll actually get to see what that looks like. And I know a lot of us are eager to do that. And so that's for the purpose of these community design workshops after the RFP goes out, is to really look at where these heights are actually happening. What are the shadow impacts? What kind of buildings are we looking at? How are these buildings used? And these are just examples of different sketches that designers use to communicate these ideas. So we'll be talking about things like stoops and setbacks. We'll be talking about, on the right here, how the just sketches of how the development fits in the context of what's around it. So we'll be able to look at that from different angles. And we'll be able to look at heights again, considering this is a different development, so we haven't done this for this site yet at all. But it's to illustrate the idea that there can be different heights with different uses, and they can fit into the context of the neighborhood in a variety of ways. And we think that doing a design workshop in this way is the best way to answer those questions. And so we're looking forward to that as well. And then one final thing is, are the open space designs, because a park is of such importance and in need to this area, we hope that we can have some conversations that really focus on park design and park use. So I would imagine that much like this park workshop you see here for Folsom and 17th, that we'll get a chance to dig into what those uses are, who the users of the space will be, and how do we design for them. And again, with that park workshop, there were some on-site visits as well where we could really talk about the space and get used to it while standing there. So that's just a flavor of what is going to come with those community design workshops. If you have more questions, I'm happy to answer them. Again, it's a long process, and we hope to get into those details after the RFP process is done. So.
Does anybody have any questions? I'm going to open it up to, does anybody have any questions or from the audience? The one thing I want to say is that, it's a caveat of several things tonight, that every picture that you saw was illustrative. It was to make a point. It's not that we're going to have six-story buildings or eight-story buildings. Everything we saw was just to give an idea. The second thing I'd like to offer is that I think now that because we have the CAC in place, that this group in particular had a rocky start with the community outreach process, and a meeting that I did not go to that involved dots that has left PTSD for some of the people in this room still. So I think that, so if you were in the room, what we promised that because we are in our roles, we will help to thank you for smiling because you know who you are if you were there, that it was a little bit overwhelming. And so I think if we're going to have a community process that it'll be engaged, that each of us representing our constituents will make sure our people are there in a way that it's really about additive and kind of building on the process that we've used here. So we won't go to any kind of free-for-all. I'm looking at Jeremy and smiling at him. But our intention will be to kind of continue with the decorum and the way that we've been running these meetings as a way to how we're going to engage people, and as well as make sure that we do a really good job for people that are not English speaking, to make sure that we've got opportunities for them with interpreters at tables, and make sure that we get, make sure we hear the collective voice of the community. So with that. So I'd like to now turn to our first agenda item, which is the second review of the principles. And what I'd like to do tonight is first start off by letting everyone know, in your handouts, what you'll see is the blue ink represents the latest rounds of changes. So now there are two rounds of track changes edits for you to look at. The red was from the first time, blue is from the second. And before I actually, I want to have Mike, I want to have you just talk about the percentages. We'll start on housing. We're on housing, I'm sorry. I jumped the gun, I assumed you knew where my head was. So the housing principle is the first the first one that we're going to be covering. So, so are you planning to stand there the entire time that we have the presentation? Okay. So I think you need to have you move to the right. It's unfair for our people if they can't see.
You guys
can
sit in the front.
Yeah, if you want to sit down. So yeah, I think it's if you want, we want to respect your voice and ability to participate. And we would also appreciate it if you could move to this, if you could move yourselves to the side. Yeah. Yeah, don't worry, I'm working on it. Yeah. And Bridget, since you're on the phone, we have a group of 1, 2, 3, about 8 or 9 people. They're with an orange banner that says "Unite with our communities, 100% affordable housing is possible." So that's, and again, we refrain from clapping because we don't want to honor or dishonor any one person's perspective. So thank you for doing what you're doing. And so before we, I'm going to talk about the changes a little bit, but the first thing I want to do is want Mike talk a little bit about the percentages and what and context for that.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mike Martin. I'm from the City's Office of Economic and Workforce Development. I'm going to do a quick set of slides that summarizes some of the reasoning in the memorandum that's over on the table that describes sort of the thinking behind the mixed income approach that we're proposing for moving forward with in the RFP. I think we'll start with a quick overview of the public lands for housing program. So as many of you have already heard, there are 4 sites currently announced for this program. The site we're talking about tonight, the Upper Yard site, which is over by the Pablo Park Station, the 1950 Mission site, which is currently the Homeless Navigation Center, but will transform into an affordable housing development for low-income people and families, and then the 4th and Folsom Central Subway Station, the air rights over which are hoped to be a housing project. So I want to go through those sites in particular, so I think I'm going to start the bottom up on this slide, sorry for that, but each of those 3 sites that I mentioned earlier are bulleted out at the bottom of this slide, and I wanted to highlight that each of those 1950 Mission and Upper Yard are already sort of in contract to do, for the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, to do 100% affordable to low incomes. The 4th and Folsom site, there's likely going to be an approval of a similar approach where MTA would sell the site to the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, again, 100% affordable to low incomes. So with that understanding of our current sort of initial portfolio, I wanted to go through sort of the policy goals that brought the public land for housing into being. The first was the Proposition K from 2 years ago, and this is confusing because there's 2 Proposition Ks I'm going to talk to you about tonight, so I've highlighted and underlined November 2014, 2 years ago. This Proposition K set city policy with a goal of 30,000 units to be constructed by 2020, with 33% of those units affordable to low and moderate incomes. And I'll talk a little bit more about income levels in this in a moment. So as part of trying to reach that goal that was set by the voters, I think over 70% approved Proposition K in 2014, the mayor initiated the Public Land for Housing Program, which is meant to identify 4,000 potential units on public land by 2020, and seeking out sites that are owned by enterprise departments, which are departments in the city that own their own property and that their budgets are funded through rates or charges or other things. And the two primary examples illustrated by the first four projects that are in the program are the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, which is funded by water and sewer rates and some power rates, and the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, which is funded in part from fares on transit, et cetera. So the goal for the Public Land for Housing Program is more ambitious than the 33% that's in Proposition K, because we see this program as a critical way to get at a number of the underserved affordability levels. So our goal is 50% affordable to low and moderate incomes program-wide. Right now, for the three projects listed here, those are 100% affordable to low incomes. So we feel like that's a really good start and a good number of units, but we want to see how we can get at not only more units to get to the 4,000 goal, but how do you get at moderate incomes and middle income, which are currently not represented in the portfolio. So again, as I said, I wanted to go back through the income levels, and instead of the really busy slide that many of you may remember with income levels all over the place, we wanted to boil it down to a family of three. So two earners perhaps and a child, one earner and two children. But this is the annual income level, and as I just sort of implied, the annual income level to qualify for each of these areas is a percentage of area median income, and that is done by a number of people in the household. So a family of two would have a lower income and be in these same groups if we did a graph for them. I just wanted to highlight that. So these graphs show the low income graph actually doesn't quite match up as I was looking at it before the meeting. That's 80% of area median income, and that's approximately a little over $70,000 a year. I'm realizing that this slide was, our original slide was keyed to 80% for another reason, which was to highlight the underproduction of moderate and middle income units. But the 55% AMI level would be around $50,000, so imagine that graph going down a little bit. The moderate income level, 120% of area median income, that is just over $110,000 a year. And the middle income level, 150% of area median income, that is just over $137,000 a year. So some affordable housing financial dynamics. Those of you that were here last month, remember that the Council of Community Housing Organizations submitted a white paper on how to improve affordability at the site. And that white paper has a number of things that make a lot of sense and that I wanted to sort of highlight here because they do play into our thinking as well. Low-income units typically require approximately $250,000 in local subsidy, and that's because there are existing federal and state subsidies for low-income units, but they don't quite fully fill the gap to allow those units to be feasibly built. And so generally speaking, I think the rule of thumb now is about $250,000 per unit. And that number actually goes up for moderate and middle income units. And that is counterintuitive, but that's because there aren't similar federal and state subsidies for moderate income units or middle income units as we're defining them. So to do affordable housing that's below market rate but above low income actually costs more subsidy from the local level. On top of that amount, site infrastructure and parks require even more funding. I think that the $250,000 per unit number comes from sort of single parcel sites where there is infrastructure that you can plug into the sewer main in the street, and you're not building a large several acres of open space next door. So that is another financial challenge for building something at this site that we've heard is of critical importance to this community, and so we want to make sure that the approach that we start with in soliciting a developer partner takes that into account. Our best chance for funding, and I think this is sort of a boiling down of, basically there's an existing set of subsidies that are used for low-income housing. The Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development has a budget. There was also an affordable housing bond that was passed that is targeting some units that we're talking about today. But that is a finite sum of dollars that is available to the city. And there are a number of projects that compete for that. The baseline Mayor's Office of Housing budget has been fully subscribed through 2020 to reach the Proposition K goal of affordable units. So what we're looking at is, can we find ways for this site to finance its own affordability? And can we bring in new streams of subsidy aside from the ones that are already called for in the Mayor's Office of Housing's building plans that could allow us to improve affordability of this site? As we've talked about in past meetings, one of the critical tools that we think can be helpful here is what's known as infrastructure financing districts. That is a state law that was recently passed that allows tax increments. So new property taxes from a development above where it started. So if you start with nothing on a development and now you build something there and it has to pay property tax, a percentage of those dollars can be put back into the site to subsidize affordable housing. That is a brand new law at the state level that's never been used, but we feel like this would be a great opportunity to use it. Because of the dynamic of the last two bullets.
Could you repeat that one more time?
Sorry, sure.
Your last.
Sure, so there is a, so some people may remember what's known as the Redevelopment Agency,
right,
which was able to use property tax increment. What I'm talking about is the increase of property taxes after they build to actually pay for community benefits, affordability, et cetera. Those agencies were abolished. Mm-hmm. The state legislature saw that that tool to use that property tax increment for affordable housing was a tool that they wanted to put back in the toolbox for local agencies. So you can form a district, and with the proper approvals at the Board of Supervisors level, the property tax, some of that property tax that's generated by the new development can be captured and put back into the development to subsidize affordable housing.
Do you have the bill number?
I do from 2 years ago, but I don't have it offhand, but I can get it to you for sure. So the challenge is that is an exciting new revenue source that could pay for subsidies, but the problem is, or the challenge is, that market rate developers, market rate units pay the full property tax, but qualifying low-income housing developments can apply for an exemption and typically do to allow their developments to pencil with the existing subsidies already going in. And if they're exempt from property tax, that funding stream doesn't exist. So our goal is really to sort of try to maximize that funding source while limiting the number of market rate units to the greatest extent we can. It's a bit of a balancing act. So now we're moving to Proposition K of 2015. So this is this last November. It amended the city surplus property ordinance, which applies to general fund agencies and their properties. So the SFPUC is not a general fund agency, so this proposition didn't directly affect it in its operative provisions. But the reason I highlight it is it makes a specific carve-out whereas most sites from general fund properties have to be developed as 100% affordable housing to low and moderate incomes. It does have a specific exception for sites with over 200 units. And that's where an opportunity exists to have a mixed income model that doesn't deplete our existing finite subsidy sources, but has a chance to sort of develop a level of affordability well in excess of what's required under law, and frankly, what's been seen on the most forward-thinking progressive mixed income developments in the city. So what that provision calls for is not less than 33% of the units would be affordable for households earning up to 120% of area median income, so the low and moderate income levels that we talked about earlier, and then at least 50% of units within financial reach of working class, middle class San Franciscans. And that's language taken from 2014 Prop K, and it's interpreted to mean middle income or up to 150% of area median income. So with that as the backdrop, we have proposed to take an approach that's basically right out of Proposition K of 2015. And not sure why that struck out, but basically this affordable housing strategy that's proposed in the memo says, so let's start by having the developers who are competing against each other provide their best offer for a self-financed affordability package. So in other words, the not less than 33% of affordable to low and moderate income households, and as much as they can do to get up to that 50% affordable to middle-class households of San Franciscans. And then, once a developer is selected, we start an exclusive negotiation process. And that allows us to negotiate additional affordability using the subsidy streams that we've been talking about today, if other dollars come available, and really with the goal of, you know, we have to satisfy a number of things to make this work. We have to, obviously, as I described earlier, talk about acquiring the site, so you need to pay fair market value to the SFPUC. You need to build the appropriate site infrastructure to serve the buildings with sewer and water. You need to pay for the right community benefits, open space, what we're doing about transportation, all the things that we're talking about in the more detailed stuff we're talking about here tonight and in the next meeting. Ultimately, this negotiation is intended so that we don't build any more market rate units that are necessary to check off each of those boxes. That where we start out with the RFP responses is not where we end up. And I wanted to show you something just to sort of give a sense of what I'm talking about. So one thing that was brought up in public comment last time was the Giants, San Francisco Giants Mission Rock development at Lot A, just south of the ballpark. It was on the ballot as Proposition D this last November. The Giants entered an exclusive negotiation agreement first in September of 2010 for that site. And when they went to the Port Commission and the Board of Supervisors in 2013, that project included 15% affordability, which was the legal baseline for public sites at that time. Then when they submitted their ballot measure in that last fall for approval, last spring, in April of 2015, for approval of their height increases, they realized that politically they needed to do better. And so the Giants proposed 33% affordability as of April. Subsequent to submitting that ballot measure, you may have seen in the paper, they had an ongoing negotiation discussion with the stakeholders they had met with in relation to their ballot measure, including the Council of Community Housing Organizations, including a number of supervisors, and all of them said, we want you to do better. And so the Giants then agreed to go up to 40% affordability level, which is below the 50 we're talking about in our parameters, but still fairly unprecedented. The only the deal that sort of eclipsed them since they're further along the approvals is the 5M project that just was approved at the Board of Supervisors. So as you can see, during this exclusive negotiation period, affordability got better. And in each turn, the task of the Port and the Giants was to figure out how can we do this level of affordability while still getting fair market value to the Port as required, because the Port is a trustee of those lands for the state. And this amount of affordability is feasible using things like we've been talking about tonight. Infrastructure financing district tax increment was already pledged in that deal. Additional other subsidies we're finding from other potential things that would be put back into that project and improve the affordability level. So all of this is a way of saying the approach we're describing here is a starting place for developers to compete on their dime, and then we come in and use our dimes to make it better. And so the target of 50% is by no means a ceiling, but it is a way to start the conversation and get to hopefully a better picture for all concerned. Ultimately, what we want is a mixed income development, because we've heard at this community meeting, at the CAC meetings and in our survey, that a mix of incomes was critical, not only for the health of the city, but for the success of a development. And so that's why we're proposing a mixed income strategy that we think complements the rest of the public lands for housing portfolio and creates a better development for this neighborhood. So that's the extent of my prepared slides, but I'm obviously happy to answer questions. I know this is a very complicated matter. So thanks very much.
So any questions from the Do you have any questions? Robert and Robert, Christina, why don't you go first and then pass the mic to Robert?
I'm just trying to figure out what are the challenges. I mean, I know that what they are, but maybe if you could be specific, the challenges of having 75% affordable housing or even just starting with 100. Like, if you could just go into that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it's something we put in the memo. For example, if you go to 100% affordable low-income units, let's say, as a starting point, and we take the 500 units that were called out of the Balboa Park Station area plan for this site, realizing that, you know, all the other parameters here will really help dictate how many units there eventually will be. Mm-hmm. You take that 500 and you multiply it by the $250,000 a unit, you get something approximating $100 million. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wish I had this math in my head.
Yeah, it's
$150
million.
$150 million. And as I talked about earlier, the source that we were talking about with the property tax increment would not exist because of that exemption I talked about earlier. So really, we're back to the existing set of subsidy funds that are now used to do all the low-income housing in the city. And we feel like having a greater competition and fighting for that finite amount of dollars, that pie, when at the same, when instead of waiting to figure out how much of that we can get every year, we pursue something that uses the site itself to subsidize the affordability, we feel like we can get units to income levels, and that, especially that moderate middle income range that aren't being served right now, sooner in this affordability crisis, not waiting for the next one. So I think that's the challenge, and that's the rub, is we think this is an opportunity to not have to go to that same spigot of money.
You may have addressed this before, but do you have any data on what the AMI is in the surrounding neighborhoods as you look at Sunnyside, as you look at Westwood Park, as you look at the Ingleside, as you look at Mission Terrace, just so we have a sense of what the concepts or what the the context is here?
I have not looked at the census data myself. I'm looking at my colleagues in case. We'll have to come back with that. We don't have that.
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful in the long run.
Yep.
I don't have a question per se, but I do have some feedback. First and foremost, on behalf of the Westwood Park Association and its residents, I wanted to thank the staff here for the movement that has been reflected in the revised parameters. We are particularly appreciative of the addition of the recognition of the residential character district for Westwood Park. We are also very much appreciative of the change in height, especially with removing the 85 feet, and respect for the yards, as well as the open space, having a 2-acre possible park is very, very desirable. You know, there's still things that are outstanding, but we also want to let you know that we did take a survey within the past week. We issued a survey on the 26th of January to all of our 670 units. And with that, we have to date gotten 239 mailed responses. I want to let you know the results because I do think that it has relevance here. And it needs to be noted that it's approximately 95% in the responses that we received that are regarding the points that I'm going to cover. And one, it is the 500 minimum as indicated in the 2009 Belleville Station Area Final Impact Report, the FEIR, the worst case scenario. I need to point out that so many residents, both in Westwood Park but throughout our neighborhood, participated in this long, long process, which was close to 10 years in the making. And it represents a hard effort, not only in getting a program or a plan that was reasonable, but it also brought together many of our neighborhoods that perhaps in previous iterations didn't communicate as well. There was a 95% support for that. There was a 95% support for 5 acres of open space. We would love it, but we're very, very happy at this point with the 2-acre recommendation. Of course, 5 acres would be nice. The building heights, I think you've already addressed this to a certain extent, but not to exceed 28 feet on the west closest to Plymouth Avenue residents with a 40 foot at the rest of the site. That's what 95% of the units or the residents would support. As far as affordability, the 95% or approximately over 90% of our residents would support 33% affordable, 15% low income, 18% with low and middle income, with the remaining being 120 to 150% of the adjusted mean income. With regard to home ownership, there was a strong desire to have at least 50% possibility that people could own their own homes in this area. I'm going to go into some areas that we're not planning covered, but I thought I'd just put it out there. That is parking, one-to-one parking for per residential unit, and replacement parking for CCSF, City College San Francisco. That's absolutely essential. And then I think that this, although we're going to be discussing this in a meeting in the future, any kind of program that does get adopted, that goes forward has to first and foremost address all of our transportation needs. And this is, of course, this is 95% of the residents. Now, I am going to do, and please take this with, you know, you have to understand, because I know that it's been a mantra of mine, and although I know that this is not transportation, but, you know, undergrounding Muni has already been a topic in San Francisco Examiner today. If they're going to underground the M, underground the K. But as I say, I know we're going to be talking about transportation later. I did want to, however, let you know that we had a survey. Within 1 week, we got 239 responses out of 675, and 95% were supportive of these particular points that I have addressed here. I will be glad to give you these comments in writing and for the minutes.
Thank you.
So before we go to CAC comments, two things. I want to first acknowledge that Super Avalos is here with us. Thank you for being here tonight. And Jen Lowe from Supervisor Yee's office. So thank you for being here. And I want to do a quick hit list of the changes to the principle. So we're clear. So that was my game. So again, blue ink is the latest round of changes. Red is the first round. Principle one. We made it explicit that the affordable housing must remain affordable in perpetuity. This has been a question that we've heard a lot, so very, very clear. Let's see some head nods, like how we did it. Per the memo, there's a correction in 1A2. It wasn't a substantive change. And then in 1B for Principle 1, we changed the language to emphasize the importance of exceeding the baseline affordable housing goals, and the expectation that the developer will apply creative solutions to this challenge. Kind of piggybacking on what Mike talked about, but the notion of it's not a ceiling but a floor. And for principle two, we clarified the language in 2A, and we replaced consider targeting with stronger language to really emphasize, because I think one of the things that we're all in agreement about is the fact that our public servants are not able to live in our city, and that a goal that I think we all hold is that this will present an opportunity for housing for those that are serving us as our public servants. And then in principle three, the change was suggested by community members, and we don't believe that change changes the meaning of the parameters, but was happy to accommodate it. And then the last one was about maximizing the pace. We pulled that out. So those are the changes for this round. So I want to open it up now to my colleagues for feedback. And John, I think you'd like to say something?
Well, I'm holding the microphone anyway. I think that passed to me. I'm in favor of a broad diversity of incomes in this property. I think it's good for people to live together in various different kinds of people living in the same place. I would like to thank the people from Podiardisha who showed up tonight asking for 100% housing, affordable housing. I understand their point of view. It's mine as well. I understand that it's public housing, it's public land, and it does leave a bad taste to think that developers are going to come in and put market rate housing in. And it leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And I think we really need to think through all of this exactly how much profit is appropriate for a developer to make in this project. The Mission Rock project is a good project, and I think maybe we have a lot to learn from that, and maybe we can exceed it. I accept the idea that maybe there might be some market rate housing, but there's so much market rate housing in this town, and it's let's call it what it is. Let's call it it's luxury housing, and we don't really need that much more of it. There's plenty already being built. It's the biggest thing in the pipeline. I accept that we will have to probably compromise on this. But I would like to see a bigger percentage of the lowest AMI people to be able to get what they need, because they're the ones that are the most desperate. Recognizing also that there are many people who are in the middle class who also can't live here, and we can't become a city of the rich and the poor. We need to have everybody represented. One thing I didn't haven't heard much about is partnering the developer with a nonprofit developer to raise the amount of I think Chuchu mentioned that as a possibility, and it's something that we may want to look at as time goes on. Is that all I want to say? Yeah, that's basically it. I would like to also, I guess we're coming at this from Prop K as far as the amount of the numbers, the baseline numbers that we're looking at. I'm wondering if those could be raised, if it's possible to actually start with a slightly higher number. We I think 50% is kind of arbitrary. We just chose it out of the air. Maybe it isn't. You can explain it to me. And anyway, this is something that's going to go on, and we're going to keep looking at it.
Anybody else? Is this just for general
this
comments?
This is general comments on the housing principles.
I'll just echo what John was saying. I'm really struggling with the percentage being so low. As someone who was born in the Excelsior, was raised there, works in San Francisco, and now lives in Oakland because I can't afford to live in San Francisco. So I really am just struggling with the percentage being so low and wanting it to be 100, but knowing that that might not be realistic, so trying to find a medium.
I have a question. With regard to the charter requirement that the SFPUC receive a market rate for the property, how does that work if we, you know, demanded 100% affordability or 50%? Does the SFPUC have a, can they veto it because they're saying that, you know, they're not going to get their full market rate potential?
I think Mike was going to address that, but I do know that the commissioners at the PUC has to vote to approve any real estate transaction. So if there is a proposed transaction before them, then that is contingent on their approval. You want to add that?
That's right. It's not so much that they can veto it, it's that they would not have, I believe, the legal authority to enter a transaction where they knew that they weren't getting fair market value, because there are trustees for the ratepayers writ large who own that asset. And so if I'm a ratepayer in another part of town and I'm saying you should use that money to lower my bills, they could be, there's a potential that they could be sued for that. So we wouldn't advise the PUC. I mean, they have their own legal advisors, but that's how I would understand the scenario to proceed if the way you described it.
Anybody else? Rob?
You know, when we're talking about affordability at this early stage, it really gets to me that we got the chicken and the egg. I mean, how can my priority and reason I wanted to serve on this committee is to make sure that we're building a quality neighborhood out here. I mean, this is 17 acres. What are we building? I mean, what's it going to look like? What's the street plan going to be? You know, how many units are we talking about? Generally speaking, affordable housing, the best kind of affordable housing is housing you didn't even know what it is. It could be all affordable, but to the passerby, it just fits into the urban fabric. And I think that's what we should be trying to accomplish here. So I'm not ready to say, yeah, this should be the ratio of affordable units. Now, that said, even at 150% of the median income, we have people in this city, you know, you can't afford a house even at 150% of the median. So really, what are we talking about here then? A word about ownership housing. They're mutually exclusive goals here. You got affordability in perpetuity, but as an ownership, the expectation is that there's going to be equity gain over time. So if you build in restrictions so that you're protecting perpetual affordability, you don't really have the ownership dream in its full glory here. You just have some hybrid. In some cases, it just becomes a glorified rental. So maybe, and there's a downside to trying to create all these additional restrictions, because then you have the additional burden of making sure that you don't have people cheating. You know, people that are quote-unquote owners, and then suddenly they're renting out their unit. Well, who's going to enforce that to make sure that the people at bottom are still living there. So in the long term, I think just managing rental housing, even if it's at 150, 120%, is probably an easier way to go administratively. So I don't have any answers here, but I think these are kind of things that we should be looking into in terms of the long term, what we're trying to accomplish here. And again, I've had calls about, well, do you support 100% affordable housing here? And I just keep thinking to myself, it's just way too early to have that conversation. Thanks.
Is this okay now? I think I'll echo a lot of what's been said, and I just want to say that I'm here to represent another CAC body, which is the SFPUC CAC. And through me, and every time we meet here, I do relay a lot of what I've heard. And at our last meeting, we had a very robust conversation, and I think I did a very fair job of, you know, laying out with all the different neighborhood groups, Ingleside Neighbors, Excelsior Neighbors, Westwood Park, and traffic concerns, concerns we've heard from the City College folks with respect to the Performing Arts Center, associated parking. And so we had this really good illuminated conversation, and a lot of those folks, even after heard everything, even knowing the market fair market value requirement for this transaction, there is just still a very strong support for seeing 100% affordable development. I think kind of come back to that, you know, it is public land, so that the notion of privatizing something that's in the public trust currently is sort of, you know, it's a difficult concept to grapple with, even though we all rationally understand sort of the financing has to work out, the project has to be feasible, that we have to cover.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's a battery issue.
So I just want to say that even all those, you know, ratepayer experts and those folks who are representing different customer segments of SFPUC customers are having the same difficulty that we're all sort of grappling with right now. And so that was our last conversation. We'll have another conversation in the next CAC meeting there. And I think I'll say that was by comparison to the Mission Rock development, that is a long-term lease, and for the real estate transaction here we're contemplating is a sale, meaning that the property is likely to be privatized, whereas in the Mission Rock development, that property is you know, reversed back to public ownership. And so I think, I just want to say that that is the conversation that folks are having there, and there's a possibility of there's a draft resolution that's been proposed. And so we're at the SFUC CAC, and we've just begun that discussion among ourselves there. There was a lot of competing diversity of opinions and perspective, not unlike the perspectives we've heard here from a lot of the folks that have been coming to these meetings and sitting through us to kind of work out these issues. So. I think that's all. That's sort of my update on what's been discussed on that body.
So with that being said, that creates a really interesting parameter, because from my perspective, I think about it in terms of being responsible to the ratepayers and being able to get the market rate. And if they're considering something other than that, could that shift how we think about it? Because, that's a law, isn't that? It's a, yeah.
So, sorry,
I seem to not be able to work the mic, but it does not shift the legal requirement that the SFPUC customers be compensated fair market valuation, because that's illegal. It's almost like I tend to think of it like a constitutional requirement for this enterprise agency. But I think, you know, so that's the
I think that's the tension right now we're seeing between different members of the CACs on our, you know, with regards to the affordability percentage of this particular proposed development.
Can I offer one other point of
clarification? So I just want to clarify that Rebecca's body is the SFPUC Citizens Advisory Committee. So similar to this CAC, it's advisory to staff at SFPUC. The SFPUC commission is kind of making the ultimate decisions about the PUC's interest, advised by SFPUC's attorneys. Correct.
Thank you for that clarification.
So I just want to just clarify further that that's absolutely correct. And so if there was any recommendation that that particular CAC wants to make, it would really, the audience there is to the SFPUC commissioners and management on how they go about in managing this this real estate transaction.
So, what I would add is that I'm completely transparent that I believe that this is an opportunity to do something that unites neighborhoods, and that in a uniting neighborhoods, you really need it to be mixed use. And that without that, it could become something that would not necessarily be integrated into the neighborhood. And I think the way to do that is community is about being shoulder to shoulder with people. And John, to kind of what you said earlier about, you know, your next door neighbor is a lawyer. You don't have legal advice. Your next door neighbor helps you, right? And if you're in the high rise tower downtown, the likelihood of you living next door to a lawyer would be very low. And so I think that there's something about this notion of how we build community in this neighborhood, given the diversity of the income levels and backgrounds and perspectives. And I think this is an opportunity to really have people come together. And that's my North Star of how I think about this project, and really how this becomes a hub that connects all the surrounding neighborhoods, particularly with the focus of City College as being, because it is City College is the largest community within our meta community. The second thing I want to say is I think this notion about returning the high return for the ratepayer is very important. And the one thing I would like, you guys aren't going to like this, but I feel having just listened to my colleagues talk about the fact about this notion of taking a public land and privatizing a public land, that's a very deep and serious thing to do. And that means that's in perpetuity. And so if we're going to do that, eyes wide open to do that, what does that really mean, and how do we, and why would we not do a 99-year lease on this? You know, what makes this different from the mission project, the Giants project? Because I think it is important for us to be eyes wide open about it, because I think if we are about being good public representatives, we represent public interest, and so we need to make sure we do that. So I don't know how we do that exactly, but I'd like to have you come, you know, we talked about this early on in terms of financing, and it's, you know, it's possible that the developer partner might come up with something interesting and creative for us to do it, but I think the problem is that as a city, what we've seen is the maximization of market rate property making lots and lots of money and not necessarily serving our collective community, and developers are about maximizing the return to their shareholders. And so in doing that, I think we need to be, we need to really figure out how to, you know, is there an alternative to this? Because it's a very heavy thing to say we're gonna give this land to whatever name the developer, and that this goes away. And I know this weighs heavy on the City College people as well, because there's no room really for expansion of City College beyond the current footprint if this happens as well. I know we've heard that from several members. So with that,
Bridget, want to weigh in?
Bridget, do you want to weigh in on housing? Are you still there? No, she's there. It's clicking away. Bridget, are you on mute?
Yes, it was on mute. Sorry.
So,
do you have anything you want to add?
What's that?
Would you like to add anything to the conversation about the housing principle as the last member? Before we go to public comment.
I couldn't hear the last part of what you said.
Do you want to have any comments on the housing principle before we open it up to public comment?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay, so we'll do a little something to try to make it better. I think I have an idea. So if you have a comment for, we're going to go to public comment now. So if you've got a comment, how this works is if you could please line up, state your name and your neighborhood or where you live, and we'll work our way through the comments.
My name is Heather Thieme, and I would like to single out one person on the board for an excellent performance, and that is Kay Faye Fried from Westwood Park. She was the only one who spoke up when 81 foot came about, and I'm very concerned about the Planning Code Affordable Housing Bonus Program, because 81 feet is 10 stories. And if you have a 20% bonus program, you get 12 stories. And we don't want that height. And I'm very glad for all your efforts. I appreciate that. And I also think that the 40 feet on the western side is too high. We were talking about 28 foot. That was proposed and it should stay this way. And then I would like to ask Mike Martin to reword that San Franciscans. Many people are San Franciscans, but they work in Oakland. That doesn't solve our problem. We want to have affordable housing for people who work in San Francisco, and that is important. For the San Francisco utility, I have a question pertaining to pipes. I was told we have a lee on the south side, but don't we also have pipes running on the west side of the property that they are remaining in the ground, right?
They're going to get back to you on that question. We're not going to respond directly. We're going to take the questions and then do like we always
Thank
do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Laura Clark. I live not too far from here on public transportation, luckily, in Noe Valley. And I'm really excited that there's more housing going to be built because I'm a renter and I know I'm going to need to move because my rent's too high. And I had a question, I guess, is there's been a lot of focus on percentage affordability, and more of a question so much as I'm wanting to make sure this is part of the mission statement, that the primary goal with all of this calculation is to maximize the total number of affordable units. And I think that that needs to be in the top of our brains, is that we are arguing a lot about percentages, and I appreciate that, but 100% of zero is zero. And so we could build one affordable housing unit, and that would maybe fulfill our goal of 100% affordable housing, but we really need to talk about total number and really focus that being the goal of all of these messing with what percentage we're going to have with market rate, with all the primary ambition to maximize the total number of affordable housing. And I hope that you guys can add total number as a primary goal as part of the principal goals of the project. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Randolph, resident of Ingleside. I'd like to echo Laura's concerns that in principle one, all of these are in percentages, and if we want to maximize the amount of good that we're doing, we should be maximizing the number of affordable units, not just the percentage that are affordable. If one developer can only build 200 units of 100% affordable housing, but another developer can build, you know, 300 units of affordable housing and then another 200 units to subsidize them, that's better for the number, that's better for the poor, basically. So for principle A, principle one, can we convert those percentages to numbers, and also principle 1D, and for principle three, or I guess Principal 1D does, I mean, principal, sorry. On the principal 3, we're just talking about creating housing without compromising quality. If we convert that back to maximize the number of housing units created without compromising the quality of design, because another goal that we have is not just to make affordable housing for people under 55% of the median income, but also to bring the market rate back down to where people who don't qualify for affordable housing are more likely to be able to afford housing in the open market as well. So I'd like to dispute the presentation where you spoke about minimizing the number of market rate housing. That should be the opposite. We should be maximizing the amount of good that this can do in the to the market, which is way too unaffordable at the moment.
Hi, Jennifer from Sunnyside. I start with Principle 3A. First of all, we appreciate your calling out City College, as it's appropriately added as relevant. Principle 3B, there's already an undercapacity of muni streetcars and buses available for the needs of the area, and access to the Balboa BART station isn't safe at night. The transportation infrastructure is inadequate. So we request that the transportation infrastructure be fixed before the new housing is constructed. And I just want to bring up tenants of a market rate housing development that was constructed on Ocean Avenue a few years ago have complained publicly about a lack of soundproofing before floors, which makes it really unattractive to people to be there. And we bring this up not knowing if the definition of quality mentioned in Principle 3B includes sound privacy between units. But if not, we suggest adding it. Just make sure that the floors are adequate. And we have one additional question. We'd like to understand the effect of the local TDMs of state legislative changes reducing the consideration of traffic impacts of new housing development. So maybe you could address that. Thank you.
Hi, Chris Hansen, Excelsior. Okay, let's see. Francisco Reservoir was sold or transferred to SF Park and Rec recently from SFPUC. I have a copy here of an SFPUC CAC resolution favoring the transfer, and I believe a nonprofit group put together the funding, paid the SFPUC $22 million for the property. This was for 15 acres on Russian Hill, so actually it may have been transferred for less than fair market value as far as Russian Hill goes. 15 acres, Russian Hill, $22 million. I don't know. This land is being turned into a park. It has stayed in the public domain, and the transfer was approved by the commission. If you would like to speak to SFPUC commission, they hold their regular meeting tomorrow, and it will be at 1:30 p.m. Number one, oh, it's City Hall, room 400. The meeting starts at 1:30. They take public comment on items not on the agenda early in the meeting, and they're also doing a presentation on flooding, which may be particularly informative for folks in the Excelsior, and they may be interested in that. And I'd like to also point to the presentation earlier. When they refer to middle income, the people that work at City College do not qualify, do not make enough money for that middle income. So it should not be confused with the middle class. What we would normally think of ourselves, or think of middle class, is not middle income. Middle income is way above where most of us would think it would be. Okay, thanks.
Bridget, did you have something? Are you there, Bridget?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear?
Yeah, I can hear now.
Good.
Hi, my name is Brian Hanlon, and I live in the Mission. I'd like to second or third the earlier comments that we should seek to maximize the number of BMR units and not the percentage. This is a really important distinction, and also just to maximize the overall number of units given the housing crisis. I'd like to just talk for 1 second about what type of city San Francisco wants to be. I was heartened to hear that our first speaker, I'm guessing an immigrant from Europe by your accent, was able to make a home here some years ago, that this was a welcoming and affordable city to people some decades ago. I'm glad that John Avalos has done such great work fighting for the rights of the undocumented and in making sure that we remain a sanctuary city. And yet, our status as being a sanctuary city is irrelevant if lower-income people cannot afford to move here. All we're doing right now is we're thinking, oh, okay, how can we help a few lottery-winning poor people who happen to live here? Meanwhile, prices are skyrocketing. And that, as the city economist said, and as every progressive economist in the country says, it is because we are not building enough market-rate housing. I assume that you two live in market-rate housing that is probably worth north of $1 million right now, if you live in the adjacent neighborhood, which is what the median housing prices are. That would be considered luxury housing in today's system. So my question for the board is, have you done any analysis of how many people will be dehoused by lowering the height limits from 85 feet to 65 feet, and indeed even lower on some parts of the property? And with this number of people who will not have housing because of this arbitrary decision, where they will live and what effect this will have on both prices and displacement in other neighborhoods? Thank you.
My name is Rita Evans, and I'm with the Sunnyside Neighborhood Association Balboa Reservoir Committee. And on the point, the principle having to do with the public realm, principle one. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I misunderstood. I guess from the agenda, it showed that all three would be.
We really decided to split it up, so.
Good evening. My name is Charlie Shamless, resident of the Excelsior. I'm here with the Communities United for Health and Justice. We're a neighborhood alliance based in District 11. I believe that all of us that are here, I can't speak for everyone in this room, but I feel like there's a real community value that's present, that we want development that meets the needs of people that are here. We want, and we think that there's a way to unite all of the communities, all of the interests that are represented here, in a way that doesn't divide us, but really develops equitable solutions. Now, we believe there is a comprehensive solution that sets the bar high, given that this is public land. And that includes affordable housing that is affordable to a wide range of incomes, open space, parking and transit, infrastructure for a fully enrolled city college, and community-based design. We don't think that these are competing interests. We think they're very complementary. We're speaking from having kind of walked the block, you know, in our neighborhoods, from the Ocean View, the Lake View, out of Mission, Excelsior. We talked to over 300 families. This wasn't an online survey, it was face-to-face conversations. There was tremendous support for 100% affordable housing on affordable land at the Upper Yard site, which is also publicly owned land that was purchased at market value and then developed for affordable housing. So the need to sell it at market rate doesn't preclude being able to achieve maximum affordability. In addition, as you all know, last week we had a really short comments from the Council of Community Housing Developers, and they presented an alternative viewpoint from what we've heard from the city. I believe that you have that report, but they really showed that we can really think strategically and creatively about how to create and maximize affordability. And I really urge you to bring them back, really to kind of break down that analysis so that you can ask the questions that you have here today, because they have a very different perspective than what we've heard from the city.
Time, thank you very much.
So it's within your power to set the bar high, and we urge you to do that. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michael. My wife and I couldn't afford to live in San Francisco. We moved out to Richmond a few years back. I'd really like to second what Laura said before about maximizing not just the percentage, but the number of affordable units that are created by this project. I'd also like to go back to what John Winston said a little bit earlier about conflating market rate housing with luxury housing. I think that's more a result of the situation we have in San Francisco. We have so little housing that any housing that is not subsidized by the city comes to be luxury housing. If we increase the amount of housing that we have in the city at all levels, we can eventually get to a point where people can actually afford to pay the market rate for an apartment. The thing is that the affordable units that we're talking about creating, you have to win a lottery to get into them. And so for people to come to San Francisco, for our children to be able to find places to live in San Francisco, we have to work to lower the rent that everybody is paying in the city. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tori Fisher. I'm an artist who lives out in Oakland because I can't afford to live in San Francisco right now. And I just want to reiterate some of the points that have already been made by some of these other people already. Like, seems we have some shared ideas about this, that specifically they focus on the ratios of affordable housing versus the actual raw numbers of affordable housing. Because as others have said, 100% of affordable housing is great, but if you only build one unit, that's still affordable housing with 100%. But if it's a 6,000 unit structure and it's 50% affordable housing, that's still 3,000 units of people who are below the median income levels who can live in this new place. And I want to address another point about parking, which was brought up earlier, where there is some insistence on 100% parking, one unit of parking for every unit of housing. I want to say that we're also two doors down from BART right now, and BART is getting new rail cars in the future, all this transit is improving in the local area, Muni is getting an infusion of cash coming in the future, and I recommend plugging into the MTA to figure out what's going on with that. So I don't believe that parking is all that necessary for something like this. And I also want to add that I am from Oakland, and it is to say that whatever doesn't get built in San Francisco ends up being pushed over to Oakland or gets pushed down the peninsula. And these other cities aren't really cooperating all that well, as I'm sure is very much aware. So it's up to everybody, including San Francisco, to build as much housing as they can at all income levels. And again, the reduction of the height in this, I would consider looking into how many people will not be able to live here because of that, and how many will end up moving over to Oakland and in turn raising my own rents. Thank you.
Good evening, my name is Jesse Fernandez. I'm a resident of the Inner Sunset, and I want to thank you for your time and for your effort and your service. I want to speak to the fact that this 17-acre opportunity is an opportunity to really provide a sense of some sense of normalcy and stabilization to low-income working-class communities in San Francisco. And these are our janitors, these are our Muni operators, these are our dishwashers, these are our teachers, these are our nurses. Folks who don't really have... excuse me, I'm sorry.
You know what, if you want to come back in a second, you can. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm Theodore from the Excelsior, and I also think that the housing, or the height limits shouldn't be decreased so drastically. Just a month, if 85 feet seems so high, it's because we're coming off of four decades of lack of proper construction around the city. And actually, I think over 100 feet could be fine as long as it fulfills the other parameters of the project. Let's see, what was the other one? I think this location is pretty good for increased density because there is a planned Balboa Park area planned to make it safer to get to the BART station and to make the Muni run more efficiently in this area. And just a month ago, a couple professors at UCLA published a paper showing that when you make mandates on that houses should be a particular size, that they should be that they have to be so big or they have to be so small, that inevitably leads to enclaves of super rich. And we don't want that, so we should give them the, we should give the developers the flexibility to make very tall buildings if they can.
Good evening, my name is Supervisor John Avalos, and I actually called each and every one of you over the past week, and most of all, I want to thank you for taking your time to sit on this CAC and to do this very, very hard work of balancing all these different interests from community and from the city and working as neighborhood residents to do that. It's no easy task. I live, my district is actually about a quarter, on the corner here of Phelan and to the south on Ocean Avenue. My district used to be all the southern side of Ocean Avenue over to Faxon, but with redistricting, my district did not have any development, but we had a population boom by like 6,000 people, and we had to decrease the size of my district to accommodate that. So we have a huge demand. We have people living in District 11 who are doubled up in houses, tripled up in houses, who are living in in-laws, often unpermitted, and that's just the reality. We fought in my district with Communities United for Health and Justice, who just talked about 100% affordability, to actually get the upper yard site designated over at Balboa Park Station at the corner of Geneva Avenue and San Jose. It took many, many years. We did not have the support of the mayor's office to do that at first. They did not see this as a viable site. We now also have another site on Mission next to Safeway in the Excelsior District that's being proposed for close to 100% affordable housing, 100% apartment housing, as townhomes that'll be for ownership on the other side. So this is actually, it's possible to look at these sites. The site next to Safeway is private land. The site next to where Balboa Park Station is public land. One of the residents who talked today talked about the Francisco Reservoir. That was actually kept as parkland, and yet the PUC still got fair market value. I believe it's possible to have this land set at 100% affordable housing and still get fair market value for what is going to be here. The Public Utility Commission's CAC is also looking at that issue. They're looking at passing a resolution to forward to the whole PUC commission to talk about 100% affordability here. And we've actually, my office and community members have talked to the Public Utility Commission commissioners as well to seek 100% affordable housing. And they're being told that it's not possible to do. I don't think we actually have a real legal opinion about whether that's possible or not. But the huge demand that we have all across San Francisco, and certainly in the Excelsior and Lakeview and the OMI neighborhoods, is huge. And we could actually help accommodate that demand by having 100% affordable here. Hundreds of units of 100% affordable. Hundreds of units of 100% affordable. It's not one unit that's 100% affordable, but hundreds of units. If we're talking about hundreds of units and other units that are unaffordable, that are luxury, that's still a percentage. So let's get 100%. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Laura Fry, and also I want to thank you. You guys are really patient. I want to apologize for this being under-researched. I brought up before how the in-lieu payments thing really looks like the city is not doing their responsibility to make sure that developers put units in their developments. Well, but if you look in the past, I mean, millions of dollars that go in fees.
We edited, it was edited not to say that the
I'm units not talking about going forward. I'm saying, I feel like the city, because of the past, of not putting the units in that they were supposed to, instead of taking fees, they've got this big backlog. So, whoa, let's just put it all in Balboa Park. There's a big space, whereas they should have been doing this for years. Instead of taking fees, I'll show you, well, it's not as research as I would like, but I'll pass these around. And tons of money have gone when developers actually wanted to put in affordable units. And then the city would say, you cannot. You have to pay fees. And it's just something is fishy here. And I just feel like the whole park area is taking the brunt of this. And then I just wanted to thank you and a couple other people that said the goal should be to make a nice neighborhood, not to just max out, just put out whatever we can get in there. It should be to make a nice neighborhood. because they've had subsidized housing before, towers and stuff like that. And they can be very nasty environments. And this should, the goal should be a nice neighborhood. And I'm glad that they took away the 85 height. And I wanted to say to Robert about the affordable. My understanding, like with Park Commons by the Kezar, that was affordable. And I think when you own, it's still, you know, as the price goes up, when you leave, it becomes affordable at a higher price. So you do get some equity out of it.
Time, thank you.
Good evening, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Tim Cole and I'm a 26-year resident of District 7, but I'm also, I run the San Francisco Housing Action Coalition. And on behalf of our 300 members, I want to thank the work that you do, but I also want to encourage you to look at this site as the priceless opportunity it truly is. A site like this comes along every generation or so. And the question of what you're going to put on it, I urge you to consider that this is not just a neighborhood issue, but really this is a responsibility to the city of San Francisco and to the region as a whole. Discussions around sites like this are taking place in cities around the Bay Area, around the country, of how do we put in more housing in areas that have great existing transit infrastructure, which this is. This is a regional transit node. This is a logical place to put a lot of housing. And the idea is that you're in a tough situation. You're going to have to figure out how to extract the value that is in this land to create the maximum benefits. I mean, we've heard lots of requests for it. We want parking. Parking's incredibly expensive. Would you rather have more parking or more affordable housing? It's going to require a choice. Open space. Want lots of open space? Open space is great. Who doesn't like it? It's expensive when there's a limited amount of land. I think that you've made a real misstep and possibly missed an opportunity by lowering the height from 85 to 65 feet, because that goes directly against what the people standing here with the banner want. They want more affordable housing. Reducing the height, you're reducing the value of what you can get out of it. You're going to have to choose. On the question of the Francisco Reservoir, if I'm not mistaken, I think that transaction book was a bunch of very, very wealthy people buying the reservoir to take it out of public use. If that kind of option is available here, maybe should pursue it. That would be a way to get 100% affordable. Affordable housing is incredibly expensive to build. We do not have the resources. The value is in the land. There are going to have to be some tough decisions on how to get there. Thank you.
Hi, my name is David Malamed. I just want to say that I think to build high-density housing will kind of clobber the neighborhood, what makes the neighborhood good. What makes people want to live in San Francisco is that there's a lot of good neighborhoods and interesting neighborhoods. And throwing away a height limit and, you know, building high-density will go against that, especially if it's done without respect for the infrastructure supporting it. I know in this area there's been a lot of power failures over the years. So I think that should be in the principle somewhere, that the infrastructure problems not be further strained. And we've all talked about that with transportation. And I really think City College should get its performance center, and that the interests of City College should be strongly considered. I mean, you know, it's certainly going to happen that there's going to be this great moral force of the need for affordable housing, but the answers aren't going to be all here. And I'm very suspicious. I mean, I think in the end, what very well could be happening is a lot of very good people are being kind of used as a cover for essentially selling off public stuff to a private developer that's going to make a lot of money.
Thank you, David.
Good evening. My name is Carol Ito. I'm a
a homeowner for over about 39 years here in Westwood Park. I'm also on the Westwood Park Board. And I basically just want to reinforce what Kate Favetti reported from our recent survey of just under 700 homeowners in our neighborhood. And I want to respectfully disagree with Supervisor Avalos, as well-intentioned as those in the audience want 100% affordability and understand the need of the city. I really hope that you as a body will recognize there needs to be a balance, how the 17 acres can meet the needs of the city, but not all on our backs out here, that you need to respect the various neighborhoods and the investments that our neighborhoods and the businesses here have made almost probably over 100 years, as our neighborhood is going to celebrate our 100 years next year. And I just want to reinforce that there needs to be a balance between the neighborhoods, our surrounding neighborhoods like Sunnyside, Westwood Park, Mission Terrace, and Ocean Avenue, business investors. And I just want to reinforce, again, we accept, you know, and realize that 33% affordability is a starting point, and that the middle class is a group that has been severely neglected in the citywide planning. And so we hope that anything above 33% would take in respect the middle income, the middle class families between the 120% and 150% of AMI, and which has been the least underserved according to the statistics you presented to us earlier in these meetings. So thank you.
Hi, my name is Linda Judge. I live in Westwood Park. I've lived there for almost 10 years. I was a renter for 7 years, and we had the amazing opportunity to purchase a home in a neighborhood that we love about 2.5 years ago. So I would like to speak specifically on this kind of, and my apologies, I don't have prepared notes, this push to define a number of units and or the push by various organizations to maximize density and height and number of units in our neighborhood. I have lived in San Francisco since 1996. I understand very deeply at a number of different levels the concern around affordability and people being pushed out of our neighborhoods in San Francisco. I know a number of people who have been pushed out. But I've also worked in real estate for 30 years, and I understand that there is always an affordability crisis in San Francisco. And those of you who have lived here for a number of years understand that as well. So it's important to thoughtfully develop this piece of land in a way that makes sense for the community, in a way that makes sense for the surrounding neighborhoods, and in a way that makes sense for the middle class, which for folks who have been involved in this process for the past year understand that this truly is the socioeconomic group that is underserved. Thank you.
Francine Lafrano, Westwood Park. I'd like to concur with everything that Linda and Carol said, and also thank you, Kate, for providing the survey results for Westwood Park. In particular, the height limit, I'm very pleased to see that it's been reduced. And also your comments about the Balboa Station area plan. I don't know if everybody's familiar with that, but as you mentioned, that was a very, very lengthy process that I participated in, neighborhood people participated in, and that stated that the worst case scenario was 500 units over there on that site. And I know we haven't nailed down the number of units, but in all due respect to everybody involved, Westwood Park does touch that development. Okay, so the height limit is crucial to our neighborhood. And then also, I think that because a lot of us, you know, do own our homes, I think that there should be some respect given to us as well. We've made investments in our community, in our homes, and pays just outrageous property tax. You know, I was lucky enough to buy my house many, many years ago, 30 years ago almost. And of course the prices weren't now then what they are now. But it has been a struggle to maintain a house. And you know, our property taxes go for things like the Performing Arts Center, those bonds, it still hasn't been built. So, you know, the property tax property owners are the ones paying the taxes that support so many things and subsidize so many things. And, you know, I think that there needs to be some, you know, respect given to us as a neighborhood who want to preserve what we've invested so long in. You know, this has been a neighborhood, as you said, we're celebrating our 100-year anniversary, and we have our residential character guidelines, and I know I moved here because I wanted to get away from the density and the sprawl and everything else. I'm a native San Franciscan, grew up in Mount Davidson, and I moved here because of that reason, to keep away from urban sprawl.
Hello, my name is Jesus. I just want to thank everybody for taking the time to organize this. I attend San Francisco State University now. Before attending there, I was a commuter, a student like many other students are here at CCSF, and I was also coming from a different city other than San Francisco. And being from a different city other than San Francisco, I didn't have the option of living with family or relatives, so many students, just like I did, had to live in cooperatives or in affordable units that were close to campus. So I just want to stress the importance and the urgency of affordable units in this area, pushing these students out farther to Pacifica and even more south is just, you know, making the entire society worse. We're talking about global warming, cars and things like that. People are gonna have to drive to campus or take 2-hour commutes to school, which they will do. So I urge you, you know, think about the children and the future of this community. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Victoria Sanchez. Okay, I'm Victoria Sanchez, and I live in Cayuga, and I belong to Bolivia. My grandchildren always ask me, Grandma, Abuelita, they tell me, when we're going to have a place to stay. I have a full house right now. My son is not working because they let him off. I got my grandchildren with me and everything. And they always tell me, we all share one bathroom for 7. And I say, mijo, one of these days, I hope this project always, I hope it's, you'll have a hope there. I try, every time we go to bed, I tell them, maybe you'll get your own room. Maybe you'll have a decent place to live. We all live in a small house, and this is a good project, and I hope it keeps on, and I hope we do something about it. Thank you.
So is that the end of comments from on housing? Okay. So, okay, sure, come on up.
My name is Carita Natividad, and I live in Westwood Park, right on Prima. And I want to thank everybody for all the good work and everything. And I commend, thank you, Kate, for emphasizing this today. And I wish I have a way of really building a high rise to accommodate everybody. That would really be good. That would be my heart. But then again, there is a balance, like Robert said. How will this project look like? How will it affect the neighborhood? That's what he said. So I agree that there will be a balance, and I'm sure we will come to a balance where everybody will be all happy. And even though we cannot really build like high rise to accommodate everybody, but there has to be a balance. And like what Linda said, that if it's really gonna be like high density or something like that, that people people in the neighborhood will be all pushed out. We will be one of them, all be pushed out. And well, thank you everybody for all your good work. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Harry.
Harry Bernstein, Merced Heights. I don't know how to reconcile all the elements that you're having to try to reconcile. The ideas from tonight that I liked there was something that was analogous to the Francisco property. If there could be some kind of look into what the options might be for making things more both affordable and community supported. I don't know what's possible. Also, we have to reconcile the current uses of the property and what needs to be done there at the right opportunity. I'll come back and talk about the, you know, instead of 60,000 students at the college, back to 100,000, we need to have numbers about exactly how much space is needed for the realistic usages, what is left over. People are talking about the number of units for living. We also need to know numbers of units for parking, just to meet the current and projected needs. And we're just instead talking about this huge open space, which I know is relatively not huge, 2 acres for open space and whatever might happen. So there are a lot of things to contend with that aren't very clear right now. But I think I'm not personally for maximizing the number of units. Certainly 3,000 is a little overdue. Maybe that's just to make us say, that's 500, at least we don't have 3,000.
Thank you. So I want to turn it back. I think that tonight we've heard from various vantage points of, and I think this is the challenge of building in an existing community with an existing type of housing stock, trying to meet the demand that's a citywide demand, and being able to put disparate desires together and to create an overarching plan that makes sense. And I think one of the things I'd like us to think about is when you know the definition of consensus, the consensus is about, is it something that you can live with? And it's not about that every single part that is that you care about is included, but is it something that we can all feel good about, that you can see yourself in it? And so I think that's got to be the spirit of how we move forward with this, because there are competing disparate needs. I think philosophically we all agree that we want to be able to maximize the property to be able to address the housing crisis and the affordability crisis. I'm struck by, I think that the affordability crisis will not be, we will not address it with this single 17-acre property. It is a much larger issue than what this one neighborhood can. We won't be able to check the box and say, oh, we solved it. We can be a contributor towards helping toward it, I think we have to be careful about how much of the responsibility that we take as a part of a larger solution. I'd like to just turn to my colleagues for a second. My recommendation is it's 8:10. I think what I'd like to do is I want to move to public comments. So before we move on, I want to just do a quick check. Do people have things that they would like to we move general comment to the end. Usually we put that at the beginning to make sure that we're making sure we're respecting people so they don't have to wait to the bitter end to get their comment in. So taking a look at the agenda tonight, we're not going to get to the, we might be able to get to the other two principles. But I don't want to do that if we need to go to general comments, because there are a lot of people that have general comments they need to make. So can I get a show of hands of people who are interested in making contributing tonight's meeting by way of a public comment, just general comment? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm sorry?
That's not already on the agenda.
that if you're not on the, if it's not one of the, covering one of the principles, particularly the first one which we're on, which is the housing, urban design, and public realm. So City College would be the next. So this agenda has way more on it than we're gonna tackle. So what I'm thinking about now is, can we get through the feedback of the revised principles, so the blue edits, to the two remaining principles we haven't covered, which is public realm and urban design. But before I move to do that, I wanted to just do a check to see how many people have general feedback that's not related to our agenda. And City College is going to be the first thing that we're going to cover in our next meeting because we know how important that topic is.
What is the date of that meeting?
That's going to be the March meeting, right? March 14th? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to make a call just because I'm just doing my best navigating stuff. I'd like to recommend that we get the feedback from Let's Move to Urban Design. And let's dig into urban design. And then what I'll do is, let's see, because I don't think we're going to have a lot of feedback to this one, but every time I say that, I'm wrong. And let's do 10 minutes of public comment from 8:20 to 8:30. So let me first turn to my colleagues to, hold on one second, let me get my head back around talking about the comments first. Hold on. So we're going to go to urban design, and if you'll notice, what you're going to look at is that the blue are the edits that were given from the feedback from last meeting that add on top of the red. I'm sorry, is there a question?
Are we getting a presentation, or are we getting?
No. What's going to happen is we've already done this once. You weren't here for the meeting where we did it the first time. So what this is the second round. So what's going to happen, just like we did on the last one, I'm going to lay out what the changes are, then I'm going to turn to my colleagues, and then I'm going to open it up to public comment. Okay? Thanks. Okay, so with that, in urban design, the language is made stronger to address the concerns. The east side has to be lower than the west, and all building facades must vary in mass and scale and material. So the idea that it's going to have a diversity of perspectives. In the preamble, we recognize the Westwood Park Residential Character District. We removed the mentions of the alley because a lot of people had feedback about alleys. We used harmonious integration with surroundings because, again, we want to make sure that it becomes contiguous and part of the community. We want to ensure a variety of architects, again, helping to create interesting, diverse designs. Reasonable distance and well-designed buffer from Westwood Park, between the berm and the spacing, so that people aren't peeking into people's backyards and that's going to be open space. We removed the 85-foot option. We recognized and enhanced the value of the rear yard open spaces, which again went back to the Westwood Park guidelines. And then we added the utilization of wind-appropriate trees, my personal favorite, to reduce the impacts of wind, knowing that not every day is like the one we just had. And then in 3B, looking at the harmonious integration with the natural context and open spaces, and again, the landscape for the appropriate microclimate, which is this lovely neighborhood. So those are the changes and the edits from our last meeting that we're incorporating. So with that, I'd like to turn to my colleagues, and if you don't have anything to add, please feel free to say, I don't have anything to add. So let me make my way. Who wants to go? Comments?
I already made my comments.
You made your comments,
yeah.
Kate? John?
I like going second. He's got a mic.
So what we're hearing, the word that I think in the word cloud, the biggest word in the word cloud tonight is balance. And that's what we have to look at when it comes to this particular set of parameters. Westwood Park is an old neighborhood. People have been living there a long time. They deserve to not be encroached upon in a way that will lower their standard of living. I understand that. For that reason, I'd like to see, we have 4 acres of open space. I'd like to see most of that open space, if not all of it, the public open space, along the edge of their backyards. I would like to see no houses at all built up against the backyards, and small amounts of on the edges of open space, and a big bulge in the middle. I mean, we can work on that, but I'd like to see some open space, and in a way that it buffers, and not only buffers between the housing and the neighborhood, but also creates a living space for everybody to, something that would actually add to the quality of life in Westwood Park. I think it would be a real great thing for the people to look out their backyard, not see a bunch of houses, but actually some open space and an extension of their backyard. It'd be like living on the edge of Dolores Park or something. It'd be really nice. Balance, though. If you want to have enough people to live on, to make this worthwhile, on the other side of the property, you might have to have some taller buildings to have a smaller footprint for more people. And also in the interest of balance, I'd like to see lots of different sizes of buildings. The taller buildings in the southwest corner over by the turn by the Phelan Loop, and the shorter buildings abutting the park, you know, on the western side. And I'd like to see all different sizes so that we don't just have big blocks of Stalinist blocks of housing. Not what I would like to see. And when I talk about, I say Stalinist, but a good example is right over here at the Whole Foods. Imagine rows and rows of those houses. It would just be awful. And I agree with the idea in general of density. I know there's some proponents of density here. I think some people did a really disservice to the whole process by publishing a picture of a little mini Hong Kong in the middle of our neighborhood. And I think that scared people a lot. And I think that by balancing a little bit of tall buildings, some small buildings, some open space, we can actually put in a lot of housing for all different kinds of incomes and for all different kinds of people. And I think it would be great. Let me see what else I have here. In terms of balance, I'd like to see all different kinds of architecture. One of the problems of building a brand new neighborhood from scratch is you don't have the organic growth that happens in an old city, you know, Boston, Chicago, Munich, Paris. You don't get to see that really fine-grained texture of a neighborhood. And I would like to see if we can do that here somehow. And it's going to take a little extra work, some creativity, and make it at least look like it grew organically. Let's see. I think that's it. Okay.
I just want to share a quote I heard this week while attending a conference on managing conflict, is that consensus does not mean unanimous agreement, and that consensus means that all parties can live with an outcome, that the outcome is balanced so that the outcome is sustained and that all parties are able to commit to the outcome. So I just want to share that because I thought today's comment, even the public comments, really reflect. I think people are, hearing a lot of the comments, even of different perspective, that people want to be here, people want to be engaged. I want to thank all the folks that have come here today and spoke up. That's all.
I did want to just reiterate our appreciation from the neighborhood that, in the sense that there's been some changes that are very positive. And I think we also need, when we're looking at, we often talk about the community, or the quality of life of the community here, we need to think about the quality of life of the new community that's coming in, and making sure that the neighborhood integrates seamlessly into the existing neighborhood.
Sure, I'll come to you next, okay.
Hello?
No. Okay, am I on here?
Hello?
Oh, yeah. Now
I am. You know, public transit, there's no mention of it here in this parameter. I know we have another one on transit, but, you know, when you talk about the urban fabric, we need to be at the very outset be talking about how we're going to have linkages to public transit so we don't have to get in our car every time to get somewhere. So if that's better walking paths, better lighting, what have you, that gets people in kind of an automatic mode where, oh, yeah, I can just catch the tram rather than, oh, I got to get in my car and get out of this little cul-de-sac here to get to public transit, I think we'll be better served in the long run. So maybe we just need to add something about our harmonized relationship between existing building streets and open spaces and public transit nodes as an additional parameter that would be added to this, just so that it's there and it's clear that there's a linkage to transportation elsewhere and another parameter, and they kind of harmonize with each other. Thanks.
Thanks, Robert. So does anyone else have anything to add? So, Bridget, I'm going to go to you. We're putting the speaker, the microphone up to the phone. Come
on, yeah. Okay. So first I'd like to thank everyone who's spoken to the microphone. I also want to say that I don't think a lot of these things that have come up tonight are mutually inconsistent, such as the Performing Arts Center and the and affordable housing. I think that can coexist beautifully. I also want people to remember that we're going to do a transportation study, so that will clear up a lot of these issues about parking and whether we need more buses or where the buses should go or what they should actually do. So these are things that are still out there and need to be built into this process. I know it's probably kind of hard to hear me, so.
No, you actually are perfect.
Yeah.
You're probably the best speaker tonight. Anything? Do you have anything else?
No, I'll talk more next time.
Great, thank you. Thank you for being with us remotely at 11:30 at night, since you are in DC. Thank you, Bridget. And let me just see if I had, I just want to make sure in my role as the Sunnyside neighborhood representative, if I have anything to add. I don't think so. I think we're good. I think that's good feedback. So let me go to, does anyone have anything they want to add from, if you want to line up, we'll do the comments. And so what we're going to do is, let me see how many there are. And this is in response to the principle we're currently looking at, which is urban design. So what I'm going to do is this, is we're going to do, and you have to stand up if you're going to stand up, and I'm going to do a math equation, and that's exactly how many minutes we're going to do. So the tall person at the end of the line, you are the last person who's going to comment. So if you don't want to make, if you want to make a comment, get behind her, because I have to actually get up to do this to see how many of you there are. Two, there's seven. So that's going to take us to probably the big hand on the 8 to 20 to 9. And then I'm going to open it up to public comment because we need to allow for that as well. So so let's go.
I'm Bob. I've lived in Sunnyside for over 30 years. In 2017, my home will celebrate its 100th birthday. I want to address Principle 2D. While recognizing the difference in proximity to the development site from Westwood Park and Sunnyside, we ask that all surrounding neighbors be accorded the same protection by building sites and designs with reasonable buffers as Westwood Park. Do not sacrifice the privacy, light, and neighborhood character of the neighborhoods to the east.
Laura. So first I wanted to address something that came up about people not being at previous meetings. I think for people like me who work full-time jobs, and I've been to a couple of these things already, and it is a great burden actually to get out here and talk to you guys about an issue that is very important to me and a lot of working people who hope to be able to live in places like this and hope to see rents come down. I just want to have a little bit more consideration for the fact that no, I wasn't at the previous meeting, but it really doesn't mean that I don't care about this issue. So a couple other things. One is that we brought up Stalinist architecture. The big problem with Stalinist architecture was that they didn't care who was going to be living in it, right? It was very functional. Developers care about selling to people, and so we can also establish that the likelihood that a developer will want to build something hideous that no one will live in is pretty low. Their goal is to create something in a neighborhood that's transit rich and that's going to have a beautiful park. They want to create desirable neighborhoods. So I appreciate that we can have a little focus on that, but we don't need to be quite so doom and gloom. Stalin, luckily, is not here. The second thing that I wanted to bring up is that we have the focus on openness provided by contiguous private open spaces. I think that that biases us towards people, towards larger, towards smaller. Principle 2D, openness provided by contiguous private open spaces. Private open spaces, by definition, do not necessarily have a public good. They have a good for those people who are lucky enough to have access to those contiguous private open spaces. For all the people who are living in the denser places and don't have access to it, it's not like they have, walk-through rights or something to those contiguous private open spaces. Thank you so much.
Ryan Hamlin. I'd like to address Principle 2B. John Winston mentioned that he wanted to see different heights, scales, materials, facades, and all the rest. And that's all like well and good, although I wouldn't have to be a very strong principle, because that does increase the cost of construction. And so if you do that, that means like fewer people are going to be housed in affordable units, because the subsidy required for each unit will be higher. So it's really important that we balance those concerns. This idea of the scale, about integrating for most of the scale, I think, this is a term that designers and architects throw around a lot, and I think it's often very much misused. Instead of thinking about the scale of the existing built environment, I think we should be thinking about the scale of the need for housing. There is a tremendous, tremendous need, and I think that's reflected in, many of the people speaking in favor of more housing are a bit younger. Many of the people speaking in favor of less housing are older. They're homeowners, they own million-dollar-plus homes, they're secure in their housing. So this is an issue that I don't think we should talk about in terms of aesthetics, because quite frankly, this is a class issue. And I think that should be noted. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Jonathan from Ingleside. Last month when we discussed the urban design parameters, a member of the public came up to me and said, get a side job and you'll be able to afford to buy a house in San Francisco.
Get three.
And I found this incredibly callous and shock, and this exhibited a shocking lack of understanding of the current economics of the housing market. In the 70s, perhaps, when she might have bought a house, the ratio of house price to income was probably somewhere around 5x, which is affordable if you work your butt off and try to and work at it. But in 1990, the median house price to median to Bay Area median income ratio was 7.4x, and in 2016 the ratio is 14.5x. That's not something that you can bridge with a side job, and so for principle 2C, I would please urge you to do not neuter the economic benefits of this unique property adjacent to the major bus terminal for aesthetic concerns. Please don't limit it to just 65 feet. That's very inappropriate. A blanket height restriction of six stories is inappropriate. And to Lisa's point, I know that we're not going to be able to solve the housing crisis with just this one development, but this also symbolizes what San Francisco is willing to do to improve the welfare of its citizens. If San Francisco, the most liberal city in our region, is not willing to provide as much housing as it, to do as much as it can to provide for the people who are being displaced, then what responsibility are we you know, are we expecting from any other cities in our peninsula?
Hi, Laura Fry, Westwood Park. 1A, it says several block scale. Again, I want to recommend that a good neighborhood feature of Westwood Park is curved streets because it helps with the wind. Supposedly, that's why they put it in to begin with. And it also is traffic calming, and it's also pretty. 2C, I suggest that there is some kind of definition of space of what kind of setback there would be. 2C, the building heights. I'm very grateful that you put it back down to 65, and I've noticed developments all over the city. Not every development is maxing out heights. There's tons of developments that are keeping to the heights of the neighborhoods. Presidio, Market, Van Ness. There's parts of the industrial area of Potrero where the heights are the same as the surrounding neighborhood. They aren't just putting it through the roof. And I wanted to say that most important that whatever the RFP, whatever is decided, that it be put as a permanent height, that no matter what kind of density bonuses are current or that they can develop in the future, that this RFP will be, this is the height. And then a couple comments to what has already been said. I really think affordability always has been a problem in San Francisco, and it probably is worse now. I can't remember hardly any time in San Francisco where I paid only 33% for housing costs. Housing costs were always a very, very large chunk of income. And I always figured just living in San Francisco was part of what my rent was. It was, I get to walk to the beach, you know, I'm paying rent to live in a place that has amenities that if I live somewhere else, I'd be cheaper rent, but I'd have to go there. And then I do have a full-time job. For you who think that everyone who lives in Westwood Park, most people in Westwood Park have full-time jobs and work very hard.
I just want to respectfully, the comment that was made was actually addressed to me because I zinged our, what's your name?
Laura.
Laura. I zinged Laura accidentally when I was just trying to give the instructions of, you know, this is like the soap opera continued from last episode. This is what we did last time. And the tone of my voice, I think, came across a little harsh. And her comment was really about something that was directed at me. It wasn't about anybody. I think most people here are working at least full time. And then we have those that are working more than full time to be able to afford to live here with those side jobs. That was a joke. So again, my apology to that. And I just want to just bring the temperature back down because that was really directed at me. Is that fair to say, Laura?
Yeah. In a friendly reminder.
Yeah, thank you.
Madeline Bueller, music teacher at City College. So anytime I see the word harmonize, I get all excited. This is principle number two, but then I'm looking at all the headings, and I realized then as I was sort of going, well, should say this, this, and this, these are drafts, and I understand. And so when you talk about the eastern neighbor, and I'm really glad, you know, we got a lot of Westwood Park, good stuff, but there's so much that will be put into this draft, I hope, and it's not just in the chapter called City College, because the urban design of thing, all of these headings apply to this neighbor. We're a neighbor over there, and all, you know, 30,000, 40,000 of our students, and we've been there 80 years, pretty long, and so in design factors, there's some really good stuff. And I hope that as you put this all together in future packages, that once we really get into the City College, especially the last thing about history and the culture and all that kind of good stuff, that that can be incorporated back into these various parameters throughout all of these meetings. We're not just a sidebar, you know, happen to be in the neighborhood. We are a big, huge neighbor, and we belong in all the parameters.
Hi, Tori. I just want to actually call out Robert for saying something I really appreciate with over there is for considering the urban design parameters and being able to consider its relation to transit access. And in particular, I myself am a huge bicyclist, and I would like to also suggest that the approach for bicycle-friendly amenities be considered in this, considering that we are right next to BART station with bike lockers and a lot of people I know bike all the time, and I commute here to San Francisco. I'm actually very appreciative of San Francisco's emphasis on biking over other methods of transportation, such as large two-ton vehicles with wheels. Thanks.
Back to my colleagues. Any last comments? No? Okay, good. So let's now go to public. Jennifer, I don't mean to call you out, but I made her sit down before because she wanted to talk about, was she doing public realm? Was she going to talk on public realm?
Yes.
Yeah, so right now we are on urban design, so we'll do that at the next meeting so we can follow up. I just want to make sure, just so you all know, if I make somebody sit down because they're not at the right topic time, I want to make sure that we give them first priority when I call them back up, because it's kind of an icky thing to be asked to sit down because you're not responding at the right time. So the last item that we're going to cover now is general public comments. Jeremy, do you have? Yeah.
Wanted to comment, you can't make it to the next meeting.
Oh, so if you wanted to comment and you can't make it to the next meeting, so the next meeting we're going to cover, we will certainly cover the public realm for sure, and City College for sure. My guess is, I'm going to take a bet that that's probably going to be enough for, maybe we can cover sustainability because that's one that's kind of kumbaya and everybody likes. So maybe we'll get to three. So we'll put that up on the agenda too. We'll put that up on the website too. But if you have comments and you can't get them in, just so that you all know, what happens is those emails all go to Philip. Philip collects them all, puts them into one PDF, and then we get a copy of them before the meeting and we read through them. So everything that you offer to us, we do see, read, and digest. So with that, does anybody have a public comment that they want to make that's not related to our agenda of tonight? So line up, and this will be the last thing of the night. Thank you all for hanging in there.
Hi, Linda Judge, Westwood Park, resident of Plymouth. Mine is actually to pass out the survey results that Kate was referring to earlier. And so to her point, I think we had 675, including the businesses on Ocean Avenue. This was sent out on, I believe, the 28th.
People received them
on the 28th. And within a week, we had 200 responses. We've gotten 37 more back. And of the 37 that are not included in this, 95-98%, according to our wonderful people who tally these things, are supportive of the board's position.
Hi, Chris Hansen again. So I think I have this question would be for Jeremy, probably. In some of our earlier presentations, it mentioned a final due diligence commission memo to determine current or future use of the property as surplus. And I'm wondering when the property was actually declared surplus, because the property has not been declared surplus? So it's potentially surplus land still. That's what they're calling it? Yeah.
It's kind of it's not a straightforward answer, but I would.
Do you want to use this one?
Hello, hi. So it has not been declared surplus, and there are formal procedures for declaring land surplus, and we can illustrate those again like you alluded to if you want in the next presentation. But part of that presentation was also from our Deputy General Manager of the PUC stating that there have been a lot of studies I'm not speaking for the PUC, but my recollection is that it's not critical to serving what it was designed for, the reservoir. There is no need for it to be a reservoir. And so there is that, but in terms of a formal declaration of surplus, that has not happened yet.
Okay. Does that seem like maybe it should have happened already? I don't know. Just.
I think that was one of the questions we asked at one of the very first meetings to have. the SFPUC is here to say that they're not planning on using the land. It's not a working reservoir. And well, let's come back and find out what would it take if that needs to happen. Let's do it. And you snuck up there, so you're the last person to. You don't need my. Go ahead. Oh, Harry's left. Okay. That's it now, guys.
Okay, I'll be quick. So, you know, I'm sorry, I got a little frustrated. I think when it comes to housing, we all get a little feisty. I want to say, I don't have a survey on it, but I think it's a great example of how throughout the city we have an extreme need for affordable housing. You've seen people come from quite a long distance just to come out here and make their voices heard. I think that we don't have a survey, but I think it's representative of a massive amount of people who have demanded more housing throughout the region. And while I've heard a lot of people saying, don't put it all on us, I think it's time for everybody to do their fair share. And I think it's time for Balboa Park to step up when we have this fantastic opportunity to really have an impact. And every community has the potential to have an impact. And I really hope that you guys can recognize the potential of this space to have that kind of an impact on the total number of houses and the total number of people who can live in this city, because we do have a crisis happening here. We have said yes to jobs all down south, and as I'm sure you're well aware, we have said yes to the Googleplex, and San Francisco didn't have a lot of control over that, over the fact that we have had this huge jobs influx into the entire Bay Area region, and now we need the housing. And yes, we also need the public transportation infrastructure, and we also need the electricity, and we also need the flooding stuff. But just because we also need all of these other things doesn't mean we should say no to the potential for housing. We need housing. And so I beg you to put that as your number one priority. Thank you.
Francine Westwood Park. Just wanted to say that I believe it's city policy to preserve neighborhoods. So I'd like to just put that out there. And also to respectfully disagree with somebody that mentioned that this is a classist argument. I don't think it's renters against owners. You know, I own my house in San Francisco, but I'd like to just say that I'm a City College graduate. I could not afford to go anywhere but City College. My parents didn't have the money to put me through any other school. So this isn't about class. I mean, I've been working since I was 14 years old. I've never not had a job. I work full time, and my comment about the meetings, about attending meetings, wasn't to disparage anybody who hasn't attended prior meetings. It was just to acknowledge the fact that we have a vested interest here. You know, when you own your own home and you have to work as hard as I've had to work for it, you have a vested interest. So I've been participating in meetings for over 10 years now and a lot of other things. So, you know, I don't mean any disrespect to anybody, but this is not a classist thing. I mean, I grew up here in San Francisco and had to struggle for everything I've ever gotten. I've never received any subsidies or anything from anybody. It's all been on my own back. So I just would like to be appreciated for that, and I'm not some person living in some luxury house and I'm set, quote unquote. I'm not set. I have to worry about how I'll pay property tax and bills and everything else, just like anybody does. And it's not, when I bought my house, it wasn't like when my parents bought their house. They had the ratio of income to housing prices was way different then. It was nothing even like that when I bought my house. The percentage of your income that went to housing is incredible. So, I mean, this is a struggle that's always ongoing. And as far as, you know, where to live and how to live and can you live in San Francisco, well, I mean, I would love to live in some really nice neighborhood like Pacific Heights or Russian Hill. I bought here because this is where I could afford. You buy where you can afford, or you live where you can afford.
Harry Bernstein, Merced Heights. Just a couple things. I remember seeing an article about why is there another CAC, and this was, of course, before this was formed. So I just wonder about the relative responsibilities of the two advisory committees, and what if the Balboa Park Station CAC comes to other conclusions about the reservoir, finds that transportation mitigations are inadequate, or other things. Does one trump the other? I don't know how they're cooperating, or if there's any authority along that line. And Jeremy, yes, I'm also interested in what the process is for declaring that land, which I thought was had been made surplus. I thought that's why this whole thing was underway. I know it's still a public land, but it's anyway, that was confusing. I was thinking also about, you know, the new housing proposal for the Giants. UCSF is there. And in December, I think there was a suit filed, I'm not sure exactly against who, but the mayor apparently really forced the chancellor to waive rights that the hospital had for emergency purposes for access. And I'm just wondering if that suit is successful and it stops the whole Giants development, would the city consider using its land such as that instead of, or in addition to this land, and maybe need less development here? Maybe that's a pipe dream and that suit isn't going to go anywhere. But I think it's a very real issue because there were legal shortcuts that shouldn't have happened.
Thank you. So that's our final comment. I want to recognize Supervisor Yee is here. You got anything to say, or you're good?
Good.
All right. So, so with that, I want to thank everybody for tonight. We will see you next month. A similar process to what we did tonight, around showing you the edits, showing you the changes, and we're going to figure out how we're going to. I think one of the things that we'll take up as the first item on the agenda when we come back is around the final. We have to finalize. Like this can't. We're not going to. The points have been very well articulated from the various perspectives, from the various vantage points. It's now our responsibility to adjust what we've heard and come back and finalize. And my recommendation is that at our next meeting, we decide at least for the housing principle and urban, and probably for the urban. Yeah, that'll be an action item for us to vote on. Okay, thank you.
Thank you guys.